This is Speaking of Faith, First Person. This online exclusive is part of Repossessing Virtue, an ongoing series in which we search for fresh ways to think and talk about the current economic crisis. I'm Shiraz Janjua, associate producer of Speaking of Faith. Here I speak with Pankaj Mishra, an Indian journalist who contributes to the New York Times and the British newspaper The Guardian. Obviously, this is a global situation in terms of the crisis.
Yeah.
Now, we know the economic impacts of this, but in what ways do you think of this as perhaps a moral or a spiritual crisis as well? And is that something that's perhaps something you might experience on a personal level? Is that something cultural, whether you see it from where you are right now in Britain or in India or anywhere else for that matter?
Well, there are many different ways of looking at this. I mean, personally, I find the culture of debt, which is responsible to a large extent for the financial crisis today of people just taking on personal debt to the point where it becomes, you know, something completely fantastical. That is something very alien to me, coming from a slightly puritanical, conservative, upper caste Hindu background, where any amount of debt, you know, it could be something very, very small, insignificant by contemporary standards, but it was seen as something deeply shameful and stigmatizing. Mm. And the idea was that you should spend what you actually earn, and you know, you save a bit, and then you spend, you create property, you build a house after you've saved enough. So this idea of just, you know, taking on a huge amount of debt was, and still actually remains, alien to you know, a large majority of Indians, and obviously a lot, you know, a lot of Indians are actually not able to access these very lucrative bank loans that were being offered to the middle class. But coming to the, you know, moral and spiritual side of it, I mean, I think, and I'm not alone in this, that this crisis has been going on for quite some time. What we're seeing is really, you know, the triumph of very dangerous ideas that a collectivity of individuals all pursuing their own self-interest will somehow miraculously lead to a better society and improve society. I think this dangerous idea that a lot of us were subscribing to consciously or unconsciously has been exposed as completely false. But the fact that this idea for such a long time had our imaginations in thrall really describes a very deep crisis that all of us have been sort of victimized by over at least the last couple of decades or so. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you say our imaginations, is that something that you would consider, you know, for everyone across the globe, or are you seeing some difference in, for example, in Britain as opposed to the U.S. or India as opposed to Britain or the U.S. as well?
Well, unfortunately, for better or worse, in the last two decades or so, this has been really dominant in the minds and imaginations of elites, not just in the West, but also in parts of the world like India and China, which actually have had very little contact with these kinds of Western ideologies, who were pursuing a very different path of national growth, of economic growth. Mm-hmm. And their perceived failures, and some of these failures are real, some of these failures these countries like India and China experienced while pursuing the separate path of economic growth, these failures have led them into also embracing this particular ideological model of free market capitalism. Again, a highly individualistic notion of you know, way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. So I think there are very few parts of the world, maybe, you know, places like Bhutan or some extremely poor places in which capitalism is simply not interested because those places offer neither resources nor markets, it's in those places where this ideology hasn't triumphed, but it really has monopolized our intellectual lives, our creative imaginations, in a way communism never did. You know, there was no phase in communism's history where it exercised such a worldwide influence and power.
So what then, you know, thinking about this worldview, is there an alternative that you might think of based on just personal, you know, reflections that you've had in terms of moral and spiritual resources that are close to your life or in the lives of people that are, you know, close to you in terms of your family or your community?
Well, I think, you know, we have to now go back to various traditions, and these traditions exist in India as well as in the West in the 19th century. You know, socialism, the idea of socialism comes out of also, you know, moral and spiritual traditions in 19th century Europe and America. And I think, you know, those traditions have always been there. We've just been neglectful of them all this time. You know, in India, you've had a figure like Gandhi, who really prescribed and sort of upheld personally in his own life a completely different vision of what we are here in this world to do. And those traditions, I think, have, I mean, certainly in a place like India, they have been kept alive by, you know, large parts of the population, which still lives in a kind of pre-modern world. Mm-hmm. And we just only have to look around to see how people, how they're living, you know, what a modern economist today might call a deprived life. You know, they're poor people. They are below the poverty line, and yet they have preserved certain values of community, of family, of a feeling of compassion for people around them, a feeling of concern that the fact that they are bound to the people they are living with in innumerable ways, and whatever affects other people also affects them, this feeling of solidarity. I think this is still very much alive in the Indian population today, and I dare say in populations in Western countries. So we don't have to invent, you know, some new solution to this extraordinary crisis, because there are these traditions all very dormant all around us.
And so is that something that you even you bring into your own everyday experiences as well?
Yes, I do. And I mean, I take, I draw great sustenance from the existence of these traditions. I mean, I personally have not, you know, subscribed or lived a kind of, you know, life of endless consumption. Mm-hmm. This is not something that I've actually ever been interested in. And although I'm exposed to it in small measures here and there, it's not something that attracts me, not mm-hmm. something that draws me. So I can't say that this crisis has left me, you know, a despondent person or has damaged me financially, because I was never really, you know, playing this particular game.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we turn to you for your insight and your thoughts about the crisis and about a different way to approach it, I wonder at the same time, what do you look for in terms of guidance in a time of crisis like this, or what kind of wisdom and leadership do you look for and do you expect to receive in our culture or just in your own community?
I think, you know, we've really given up on the idea of receiving wisdom of any kind from our political and business elites. So it's a bit of an imaginative leap mm-hmm. to make today when you expect people in political positions or in sort of high corporate positions to say something that is actually wise, as opposed to just being, you know, something that's attuned to achieving short-term profits.
And why do you think that is, that we don't expect that anymore?
That we don't expect that, and we've been prepared by, you know, a series of completely unwise decisions taken by these elites over the last two decades, that we simply don't trust them anymore. Hmm. That said, I think, you know, I mean, like a lot of people around the world, I'm greatly enthused by the election of Barack Obama mm-hmm. as the president of the United States. So if you ask me if there is one leader mm-hmm. I'd look to at this point for anything resembling wisdom in the old sense of the word, I think it would be Barack Obama. You know, even in India, the prime minister today, who actually inaugurated the globalization of India's economy, he gave an interview a couple of years back to an Indian business newspaper, an interview which has been almost entirely ignored, but he said things of great wisdom in there. He hasn't repeated them publicly, at least I'm not aware of of that, but he said, you know, how there's no way a country of more than 1 billion people can attain the lifestyle, say, of 300, 400 million middle-class Europeans and Americans. Mm-hmm. There's no way we can arrive there. Only a very small percentage of India's population, no matter how fast our growth is, will actually live these particular lifestyles that we are being promised by this particular business model, by this particular model of economic growth. So we have to actually learn from Gandhi and learn to live, you know, somewhat sort of austere lives. Mm-hmm. That there is no way a country like India, with its limited resources, can support that many people living, you know, such very very expensive consumerist lives. Now that is a very disconcerting, very disturbing message mm-hmm. for a lot of people who have invested a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of energy into aligning India with this particular model of economic growth, of endless growth, of endless consumption, and endlessly creating new things for people to want and to desire. This is very disturbing to hear that actually only a small percentage would be able to access them. And even though those people would be able to access them at enormous cost. So in other words, if I'm looking for wisdom from our political and business leadership, I think it would be this kind of wisdom.
Mm-hmm. And so, and outside of the political sphere, what kind of just wise thought have you come across perhaps lately that has sounded to you like something that we ought to hear more of?
Well, I think, you know, the most important intellectual development and certainly a spiritual advance for mankind in the last few years has been the recognition that environmentally, we are in a very short fuse, and that you know, what is now being described, unfortunately, as the business of green, the fact that green ideas are now establishing themselves in the mainstream, I think this is yet another source of wisdom. And again, if you examine these ideas at their core, they are very much the ideas that are contained by various, you know, religious and spiritual traditions, both in the West and in the East. So I think that is an important source of wisdom today. And, you know, you can get it from someone like Al Gore, who was a politician and still remains a politician in some ways, or you could get it from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist leader. But the fact that these ideas now have currency, they have credibility in a way they never did, I think is a very important development.
You've been listening to Pankaj Mishra. He is an Indian journalist, essayist, and novelist. His most recent book is Temptations of the West: How to Be Modern in India, Pakistan, Tibet, and Beyond. This is Repossessing Virtue, Speaking of Faith's continuing exploration of the economic crisis. For more, subscribe to the SOF podcast and visit speakingoffaith.org.